Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, and join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hi, I'm Michael Owen, and you're listening to the Football Ramble.
Michael Owen. Absolute pleasure to be talking to you.
Thank you.
Where to begin? I suppose we'll begin at the start when you burst onto the scene at Liverpool. When you started, you know, you scored that goal away at Wimbledon, and it just all went uphill from there. When you were a young teenager trying to get into that Liverpool first team, and obviously did so successfully, what were your goals? Did you think to yourself, I just want to get in the first team, or did you think, you know, I've got something, and I really want to show the world what I've got.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to say. I suppose I know what the answer is, but you know, you don't want to. You know, you spend all your life thinking in a certain way, but trying not to let it come across, because you'd come across as a right arrogant thing. But I was better than everybody as a kid.
Absolutely. Well,
so I knew I wasn't going to just be a footballer. It was how far in the world's pecking order I could get to, is the simple answer. I mean, I broke every record there was to break for England and every youth team game and things like that. So it's not pleasant saying it, but I'm
glad you did say that, because it's almost quite reassuring, because, you know, I played football at grassroots level, didn't get anywhere, but you know, and so many people do. But if you do have an ounce of talent, even at school level or whatever level you're playing at, you want people, you want to show people what you're doing. It's your art. It's your, well, and eventually your work.
Oh, no embarrassment in terms of showing it. I would show off to the world if I could when I was a kid. But
well, you did in France 98, I would argue.
But mentally, you know, as you've just asked me, did you think you were just going to come on and mm-hmm. be a first team player, or did you think you was, well, no way. I knew I was going to be a footballer from when I was 8 or 9. I was miles clear of anyone else. I was breaking the records for the county team when I was 3 years younger than everyone else. I was playing under 11 for the county at 7 years old. I mean, it was just unheard of. I knew I was going to be a footballer very early on, and nothing really changed my mind throughout my youth career. And as I say, I broke into the Liverpool team at 17, and it was just a question of, you know, how high can you go, I suppose.
And of course, you had those records, as you've just said, when you were a young player, and that just adds to the confidence that, you know, you probably had within you. But what about other young players? You know, did other players, do you think they had the confidence you had? Or do you think they would sort of think, well, I just, you know, I hope, and, you know, rather than say, I knew I was going to get into, they sort of hoped or wished, that kind of idea?
Well, it's chicken and egg, I think. You can't believe that you're brilliant when you're not, and you can't have, you know, you can't be very good at something and, you know, think that you're terrible. You know, so I was scoring goals all the time. I was playing against supposedly the best teams and the best countries and the best, and I was being the best player on the pitch all the time. So what are you supposed to believe? You know, mm-hmm. you have to think, bloody hell, I'm good at this game. Mm-hmm. I'm very good at this. I'm getting better at this game, type of thing. So what drives what? You know, is it your natural ability then drives the confidence, or is it because you're so super confident naturally that you actually play even better than everyone else? It's a very hard one to say, but I think they probably drive each other in many ways.
And your first full season in Liverpool, your joint top scorer in the Premier League, your PFA Young Player of the Year. I mean, incredible first full season at a huge club like Liverpool, and this confidence you speak of. Yet you always had a very calm exterior. You know, this didn't seem to go to your head. You were still, you know, you played in England squads. How did you manage to do that? Because the fame and the attention you got at a very, very young age from, as you say, the talent you speak about, that would mess with most people's heads, even if people are far older than a teenager.
Well, it would, I suppose. And when I look back now, then, of course, I deal with a lot of young players and see their frailties mentally and almost, I thought it was normal. I thought, you know, just getting into the team was normal. It happens. I wasn't the first player to have made my debut and scored a goal and played well and got into the England team. It was happening quickly, but that's just what I always was. It was always, in my mind, always going to happen. It might have been surprising to anybody else, but I knew it was going to happen, you know. So you
prepared for it, perhaps?
Definitely. Yeah. But I do think that mentally I was, I always was mates with people that were older than me. I was always brought up, I was part of a big family, so, you know, you're a little bit, you know, streetwise, I suppose, quite mature for my age mentally, maybe not physically, but certainly mentally I was very mature for my age, and you learn fast. If you don't, you know, it's sink or swim. You know, I was getting thrust in front of a camera when I was 17 and being expected to do an interview. I was getting pushed in front of in a boardroom or in front of 100 fans and having to do a speech and meet people and autographs and photo and all these things that, like, it's abnormal, really. But if you get pushed into the situation so many times, it just becomes normal. And now, you know, having had 20 years of doing it, that's just life now. You know, it's easy to walk into it. It's easy to sit in front of a camera and talk. It's easy to, but I had no option. That was just, and it either screws with your head, I suppose. It can happen to some people, or you just take it for what it is and you can just do it.
Sure. And then, of course, you know, putting in these performances for Liverpool, everyone in England obviously knew who you were, Britain and probably far wider than that. But World Cup 98 was when you announced yourself on the world stage. Because I suppose back then the World Cup was seen as perhaps more of the world stage than what we have now with television and Champions League. And, you know, when you were called up, you know, you're in there with four forwards: Alan Shearer, Les Ferdinand, Teddy Sheringham, and yourself. And you break into the team. I mean, again, was that Did that give you sort of an euphoric feeling? Or did you just think, well, no, I've worked hard and I'm here on merit? You know, what was the sort of feeling around that? Playing up front foot with Alan, yeah. The great Alan Shearer for England.
I know it sounds mad, I suppose, but no, you don't think like that. I mean, yes, I had heroes. Yes, when I was 12 and 14, I had Robbie Fowler and, mm-hmm. you know, Liverpool players plastered on my wall. So they are heroes. And for the first month while you train with them, they remain sort of heroes, but you quickly realise that
they're just people.
You know, they're just people. And you're actually a little bit better, a little bit worse, whatever you are, on the training pitch as well. So mm-hmm. they've got frailties. You're just people, as you say. You know, don't build these people up to be in, mm-hmm. you know, they are just people. They're very talented at what they do, but they're just people. And I wasn't really nervous about meeting people or training with. I didn't ever go shy or anything else. I just still played my own game with, and I suppose that's just a confidence thing. I think the one time that I was a little bit wow was when I first met up with England, and we'd just played Chelsea on a Sunday, so we were meeting up late, and me, Paul Ince, McManaman and Robbie Fowler all going down, driving down in the same car, and we walked into the hotel, and it was early hours of the morning because, as I said, we'd finished late, and the lads were giving me a bit of a tour of the hotel. This is where we meet for breakfast in the morning, do this, do that. And we walked into the meeting room, and there was Gazza playing a computer game. And he was, you know, as I say, it was about 1 or 2 in the morning. Yeah. And at that point, I just thought, wow, that's Gazza. Now, he made me think, wow. But again, the next day in training, I want to show Gazza how good I am.
Of course.
You know?
Absolutely right. And then at France 98, of course, you know, that goal against Argentina, it catapulted you into that kind of, as I say, gave you that world fame. But one thing I wanted to ask you, and I'd heard you say this on a previous interview, when you took a penalty in the penalty shootout, and you took a few, you know, off the top of my head, 2 or 3 maybe penalties in penalty shootouts for England over the years, you spoke of a desire maybe not to miss rather than to score. And in the World Cup just gone in 2018, Gareth Southgate did so much work on penalties, and it just about came through. Of course, can you sort of talk us through that the mindset you had when you were going up to take that penalty? Because this was a game when you'd scored one of the best goals an England player had ever scored, and of course you'd won the penalty and got us going.
Yeah, I mean, well, my mindset was obviously I was confident because I'd felt as if I played well and I'd scored a goal. So I was confident. I'd never missed a penalty or anything like that prior. So I was confident. However, I had seen, you know, you can't be blinkered all your life. I had seen Gareth Southgate, you just mentioned, he'd missed a penalty. He ends up on a pizza advert. You've got, you know, Stuart Pearce, you've got all these things. People remember the ones that miss, sadly, and they get an awful lot of stick and do something wrong, and next day all the papers got a turnip on your head and all these things that sound really funny to everyone, but when it's you, I suppose it scars you for the rest of your life. And I don't know whether it's right or wrong. I have a fair idea. I know how I felt, and I'm happy to admit that when I was walking up to take the penalty, I thought I was going to score. I knew I was going to score. Mm-hmm. I was confident I was going to score. However, when I scored it, I didn't think, get in there, joy. I thought, thank God it's not me that's going to be scarred, that's going to be absolutely castigated for the rest of my life. Thank God that, you know, people remember that. And, okay, I understand why, but... And I don't know whether that relief of not being the one is the right feeling to have or not, and I don't think it is, but that's just what I was brought up with, and that's possibly why, you know, over years we've lost more penalty shootouts than we've won.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, you had an amazing England career. I mean, 89 caps, 40 goals. Very few people have scored more goals than yourself for England. When you look back at your England career, are there any particular... really real high points? Obviously you've got the goal for Argentina, but any that you would, that perhaps the public wouldn't immediately think of?
Well, of course, winning 5-1 in Germany and scoring a hat-trick was pretty cool.
Yeah, I can imagine. So
that was great to get to the World Cup in Japan. I mean, quarterfinals against Brazil in Japan, dinking a ball over the goalkeeper to go 1-0 up, you're thinking, if we win this, we're playing, I don't know, I think it was Turkey and then Germany. Germany. Yeah. well, we've just beaten both of those very recently. We've just beaten Germany 5-1. We genuinely felt that that was the final. If we win this, we're going to win it. You know, to go 1-0 up was pretty special, but of course it turned out to be not an important goal, but at the time it was.
Yeah, I think that was probably the most gutted I've been as an England fan in 2002, because I agree with you. I thought that was, from my point of view, as a mere fan, that was the final. But of course, you know, a Brazilian side with those kind of players, you know, you can't have too many complaints, I suppose. No,
well, I mean, there was so many great England moments. Again, European Championships quarterfinals, I scored after a couple of minutes against Portugal. Unfortunately, 5 minutes later, Rooney breaks his foot. And then we all know what happened. 2-2, went to penalties, we get knocked out. But again, scoring in the quarterfinals of the Euros was big at the time, going 1-0 up. I mean, sounds stupid, but I love the game. Well, it's just a personal favourite, but we beat Argentina 3-2 in a friendly one in Switzerland.
Yeah.
In Switzerland. And I scored two in the last few minutes.
Do you know, I need to personally thank you for that, actually, because I was travelling in South America at the time, and that happened about a month before I went to Argentina. Yeah. So I was walking around that country beaming.
I mean, they're probably the least two important goals that I scored for England, but they were brilliant. I mean, the rivalry and everything else, we'd just been beaten by them, obviously, in 98 as well. So there was a bit of animosity, because I felt, well, I know we were a better team than them in 98, but circumstances went against us. But so there was always that, you know, we have to beat these.
But with Argentina, they're a side famed for producing great footballers, but also they do employ the dark arts a little bit. Were they one side, and maybe Brazil as well, who, when you played against them, you knew that you were going to get the shirt or the little... Obviously, there's a lot of players that do that, but were they particularly, I suppose, bad or good, depending on how you interpret
it? Yeah, they were, no question, they were streetwise. Mm. You know, different parts of the world, you always know what you're going to get. You know you're going to get a very fair game if you play against a Scandinavian team. Mm-hmm. You know you're going to be tested to the max against the... You know, South Americans, they're streetwise. They know how to play. They know how to win. They've probably been kicking balls in the street since they were 2 or 3 years old. And, you know, if they don't win, then, you know, finding out a way to win next time, whether it's to kick someone, punch them or bite them or whatever it might be, they know how to do it. Mm-hmm. And you've got to hand it to them that they're tough and they know how to win. So, and of course, they're massively skillful as well, but... You know, you've got to have your wits about you in certain games. And I don't think, if I'm honest, that England have. I think we've been beaten on penalties a few times, but also in my time, we've almost, you know, thrown it away ourselves by doing, you know,
having a lack of street wisdom, as you say, mate.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've gone down to 10 men lots of times. We've given penalties away. We've done a lot of things that you just think, you know, we need to be a little bit cuter like the South Americans.
Mm. Did you, when you worked under Sven-Göran Eriksson for England, did you think that he might bring a bit of that sort of street wisdom? You know, a foreigner coming in.
No, I don't think so. I don't think you can really bring it in as a coach. I think, you know, the heat of the battle, you go to your reserves, you go to what comes natural to you, what you've done all your life. You know, a manager can bring a tactics, you know, how to set you up and things like that, what to do, set pieces and, you know, whatever it might be, counter-attacking or high-pressing or these different things. But, you know, when a ball drops to me 12 yards out, there's no coach in the world that can, you know, there's no coach in the world that can tell me what to do, really. How can you tell Paul Scholes how to pass a ball? Do you think Sir Alex Ferguson told him how to do that? Do you think Sir Alex Ferguson told David Beckham how to cross this amazing ball that he perfected over life? No, no one does. You know, it's all individual to the player. A manager shapes you up in a certain way, but he can't give you anything. He can't give you that streetwise, you know, thing that we're talking about here, or that bit of quality that, you know, it's. I think it's almost a bit of a myth. You know, people think managers know everything about football, or you know, or are experts in every field. Well, they don't. They just put the great players out in certain ways and try to find the best out of them, but then they let them do the stuff.
Absolutely. I'd love to ask you about your time at Real Madrid. Because you know, over the years of playing at Liverpool, you won trophies, you won the Ballon d'Or, scoring lots of goals. And then you go to Real Madrid. Now, did that kind of give you a sort of a wow or a factor, or were you slightly fazed by that? Because, I mean, really, no disrespect to other clubs, but, I mean, that's Real Madrid. You know, you can't really go higher than that in the game.
Well, and that's exactly why I signed for Real Madrid, because I just thought it's an opportunity that if I say no, I'd be sat here, I'd be... forever thinking I could have played for that team in white that have got the Galactico players.
Figo, Ronaldo,
Zidane,
Beckham.
Everyone. It was just an amazing team. Live in a different country, speak a different language. And I just thought, I've got to try it. I was hoping I could always go back to Liverpool. You know, that was the hope. But if I had said no, I just thought, you know, that would be an opportunity or an experience missed. Now, in hindsight, would I have gone? What would have I done, you know, with the way that things panned out afterwards? But I have no regrets, and I definitely would have done the same again. It just so happened I couldn't go back to my club. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, Torres signs, outstanding. You know, then I get injured, and then, you know, a year or so later, Suarez signs, just out of this world, off the planet, what a player. Yeah. So it never happened. I could never get back to what I consider my club. And for that, I'm disappointed, but don't regret, because, as I say, for all the right reasons, I thought I'd sample it. Listen, one of Liverpool's greatest ever players, and Ian Rush, did exactly the same as me. He was fortunate he managed to get back. I was unfortunate that the opportunity never arose again.
When you were at Real Madrid playing with these, you know, as you say, Galacticos and amazing players, you must have been frustrated with your lack of game time, of course. You know, how does one, as a striker like yourself, deal with that then? Because you've got players, you know, Raul is a club legend in front of you, Ronaldo is playing, and when you're coming on, you're scoring goals, you're doing things. Yeah, how do you deal with that?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, when I first said to Jamie Carragher, we were away on pre-season with Liverpool, and I said, Real Madrid have come in. And he was like, don't go.
I bet he did.
And I said, why not? He says, you'll never play, mate. You know, you've got Ronaldo, greatest striker in the world. You've got Raul, who's a darling. Then you've got Morientes and all these players. He says, you won't play. And he, to this day, just laughs at me, the brazen self-belief and confidence. I was convinced that, well, I'm better than all them type of attitude. So I had that attitude, no question about it. I went there thinking, well, if I don't start, then I'll get myself into the team very soon.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the air in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Secondly, I mean, perception is everything, obviously, in football. I played an awful lot. People think that oh, Michael Owen, he came on a sub every time and scored every time, and he was harshly treated because he never played. I mean, I started more games than I came on. I think someone said to me the other day, I started 20 and I came on 18 or something. So I actually started more games than not. I think it was only Iker Casillas that played more minutes than me, someone said, or more games than me, one or the other. But everyone thinks, oh, you never played and you came on as sub for 5 minutes at the end and you scored a goal and your goals were good and your goal to minutes were great. But it's not strictly true. I mean, I played an awful lot and I think I scored in 9 or 10 games on the bounce. Nearly equal. I think I was one game or I did equal the all-time record of games on the bounce or something. I scored in the El Clasico, in the Champions League. I mean, I had a great time out there. I don't get the credit. I just think that people think that it was something that it wasn't and people are brainwashed into thinking that I'd never played or something, whereas I had a good, successful time out there.
Yeah, absolutely right. And you know, from playing with Real Madrid, one of the biggest sides in the world, towards the end of your career, you find yourself at Manchester United, which I think you said, you know, you were rather surprised at yourself. Was that, I mean, what was it like playing under Sir Alex Ferguson? So much written about him, so much said about him. That must have been quite an experience.
It was. You get to a stage in your life, don't you? I mean, I was so in such a twizz at the start because every you're getting scoring goals and awards are coming and you just think this is normal. But later on in life, you start viewing everything in a different way. And towards the end of my career, I was thinking, do I want to go into management? Oh, my word, Manchester United, you know, wouldn't it be great to see what Sir Alex... I always remember coming off the pitch off the first time, looking at my phone in the dressing room, Cara texts me. I mean, we're big mates.
Yeah.
Phone me as soon as you can. I want you to let me know what a Fergie team talk was like.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's what
yeah.
everyone wants. Yeah. It's what everyone sort of... It's just the intrigue of it. Why was he so successful? And just watching him work, watching the team work. Listen, these are... Giggs is the Scholes, the Nevilles, the Beckhams, all these players have, they've really shown the way for many, many years combined, but led by him. So these players, just to see what it's like to be in and around serial winners. Now, don't get me wrong, I played in very successful teams that had that winning mentality, but these are lads and this manager have just done it a lifetime. So it was fascinating to join, to see that, to obviously play in the Champions League again. And for my own sake, you know, I'd been at Newcastle and I think the next move for me, you know, I wanted to go to Liverpool. Liverpool would have been my dream move all the time. But when Liverpool weren't interested, of course, you're going to play for the best team you possibly can. Who wouldn't? If you got offered the best journalism job or the best job, of course, you're going to leave wherever you are to go to a better one. You want to succeed in your life. You want to be better. You want to extend yourself. And... you know, to get an opportunity to go to Manchester United to play in the Champions League and things like that and play for a team that were winning the league regularly, it was unbelievable at that stage of my career, considering my powers were really waning at that point and I knew I was only going to be a bit part player. But to be honest, I thought to myself at that time, I prefer to play 40, 50% of the time than play 100% of the time for a team near the bottom of the league. So
Absolutely. And how was Ferguson with you? Because he spoke... you know, very highly of you, of course, understandably so. And with regards to the team talks, you know, I was chatting to Dennis Irwin once, and he said that he would often give you an absolute rollicking after you won. Whereas if you lose, actually, he wasn't too full on, which was quite an interesting sort of psychology behind that.
Yeah, I mean, he would have his people that he would have a go at. And the one thing that I was... intrigued with, impressed with, and listen, he owns a horse with me at my stables now, so I often ask him some of these questions when he comes and visits and we go out for lunch or whatever we do. And he knows a character, you know, he knows who, if he was trying to get a message to someone that he thought he would break if he had a pop at them, he would never directly go to them. He would go to someone else that he knows, like Wayne Rooney, for example. He used to get the wrath of Fergie every single half time. Wayne could have scored a hat trick at half time, but he used to just respond for criticism. And you could let's say Nani was dribbling all the time and losing it, but Rooney had scored a hat trick and he didn't want Nani to dribble anyway. Well, if he had had a go at Nani, he would have broken him in half. He's just not that person. So he would start telling Wayne to stop dribbling but screaming at him. And Wayne would be fiery and fight back. And he'd go and score another four in the second half because it just motivated him. But he was actually getting his message to Nani, let's say, in this case. So he would have 3 or 4 players that he would have a go at regularly. But he was always knew who he could and couldn't sort of get a tune out of.
And it's the ultimate man management, I suppose you could say.
Definitely, to understand your players, to understand characters, to understand who you would lose, probably for the season, not just for a couple of weeks, if you tore into them, and who you could get even more out of by, you know, saying certain things, is the ultimate man management, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And that goal you scored against Manchester City, you know, was will go down as sort of Manchester folklore. What a game to play in, and to be the player who had the last say on the whole day.
It was. I mean, so early in my new career, let's say, at the Stretford end, and the game was just beautifully poised, wasn't it, just to do that. It was, you know, to-ing and fro-ing. And, yeah, it was just one of those things early in my career to score that goal. It made me feel happy, obviously, for one. But, of course, having the pass that I did at Liverpool, you're always concerned that you're never going to be accepted so well. So I think after that, I gained a lot of respect, let's say. And even now, people come up to me and say, you know, if it's a Man United fan, say about that goal in the 96th minute or wherever it was. So there's moments like that are what define your career. I scored loads of goals in my career, but, you know, there's only a few that I look back on. If you say remember the great times, there's about six or seven that I think, well, that was that and that was that. And of course, that was one of them. And they're the moments, not how many things you've won, because, listen, you can be a bang average player being in a great team and win 10 titles just because you've got some great players playing alongside you. It's those moments, I think, in your career that you look back on and that you did well in that are great.
Yeah, absolutely. And just finally, Michael, you know, absolutely, I hear what you're saying completely about those kind of memories and moments and so on. When you look back at your career as a whole, you know, you had some horrendous injuries, but despite that, you know, you achieved an awful lot. Do you look back and you think, if only I didn't get injured, or do you just sort of think to yourself,
oh God, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay. Well, I wondered because one or two players may think, do you know what? Despite that, I still achieved an awful lot. But I suppose you think to yourself, it could have been more, maybe.
Absolutely. That's my, you know, I'm wired like that. You know, I'm just never happy. I'm content. I'm very happy. But I'm never, you know, when I retired, I almost breathed a sigh of relief that I'm off that bandwagon. I'm off the treadmill. You know, you speak to people like Tony McCoy, you know, the greatest jockey ever. There's no fun in doing what you do a lot of the time. It's the fear. He, you know, there's no fun in him winning a race anymore. He's done it 3,000-4,000 times. I mean, there's no real buzz anymore. But the fear of someone else being better than you is just, you know, it drives you on and on and on. Now, I had that from 17 till 24. I felt like I was, you know, at the top of the game. For the rest of my career, you can't kid yourself, I knew that injuries had taken the toll. I knew I couldn't sprint anymore. And I can't tell you how painful that is mentally. When Paul Scholes gets the ball, or Steven Gerrard gets the ball, or whoever it is, and you know what to do, you've got a sixth sense between you, you know where to run, and you think, I can't. I've just got to come short to feet. And then you get, you know, and you end up just being a player that, and all I had to rely on was finishing. I knew where the ball was going to drop. I was a good finisher. I was instinctive. But one thing that probably does my head in more than anything is that lots of people only remember me for the last 5 years. And that's what I'd hate to be remembered for, because even though I was still playing at the top level, I was just a finisher, a good finisher, don't get me wrong. And, you know, if you'd said to me at the start of my career, you know, you're still going to be kicking the ball about in the Champions League at 30 or whatever, then, of course, 32, then I would have been happy. But I wasn't, and, you know, I couldn't play the game like I used to. And for that is probably the regrets, or when I go to bed at night thinking, if only I wasn't injured, and if only I was the player I was at 17, 18, 19, 20 for the rest of my career, then I think people would see me in probably a different light.
I've no doubt that there's an awful lot of England fans out there who
remember the
who
good
remember
times.
The good times.
And well, if not, I remember
and
them.
If they, so. And if they're younger, they certainly will look back, because you know, some of the goals you scored and so on are etched in English football history. But Michael Owen, thank you very much indeed.
No, thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.